You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 266. This is Features Editor John Gentile. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast, and we got a special episode tonight. First of all, we're always here with the main guy, the big gun, the heavy hitter, the man of business, the man of reason, the man that manages Punk News, managing editor, Adam White. Adam White, what's happening up there in Canada? How's the snow and the polar bears treating you? What's going on?
I'm gazing longingly at my tambourine and wondering if it should be involved in this show again.
I think
it was probably a bad idea that it was last time, so I'm just going to leave it alone.
I think the more tambourine, the better, honestly. I am pro-tambourine.
I generally am, but, you know, you don't want to wreck it.
Mr. Tambourine's, man, play a song for me. And also, speaking of folk, speaking of Bob Dylan vibes, speaking of Bird vibes, we are here with a legend of punk rock. We are here with a guy that you should gasp, that you should clutch at yourself when you hear just the mention of this guy. We are here with a guy that was punking it up in the early 90s, the late 90s, the 2000s, and now he's been all around the block. He's been all around the world. This guy's been from Delco to Philadelphia and back. This guy is, he's a punk rock legend. We are here with Joel Tannenbaum of Plow United, Joel Tannenbaum of X-Friends, Joel Tannenbaum of Ghosts in the Graveyard, and now Joel Tannenbaum of the Rentiers. Joel, what's happening? Welcome to the Punk News Podcast.
How's it going, man? I don't know if I can live up to that intro.
Well, one interesting thing that people don't realize about Joel, Adam, is Joel is extraordinarily tall.
Joel, this is really, really important shit. I'm glad that I know this now.
Joel, how tall are you? Like 6'5" or something?
No, I'm 6'3", man.
You seem
I'm
way
not
taller
like
than
NBA
that.
Tall.
You're only 3 inches taller than I am. You seem way taller than that.
It's funny how subjective that can be.
Maybe because you're skinny. You're like pretty skinny too. Joel, what do you weigh?
I'm trying to keep it below 200. That's the game right now.
Yeah, that doesn't even seem, I mean, 200 is fit, you know, but that doesn't seem like, I thought you would say like 170.
Oh, I wish, man. That's my fighting weight. Always trying to get back there.
I don't know. Joel, have you ever considered being a male model because you are so tall and skinny?
I have not. That hasn't even come up.
And here's the reason I bring it up, and we'll get to the actual meat of our conversation. But I feel as though there's a crisis in the high fashion industry, and I'm not going to name names because I don't want to get sued. But there's this guy, he's either a photographer or a fashion designer, and he's kind of like the Rick Rubin of fashion, male fashion. And so I was watching this fashion show with my mom when I was over at my parents' house last week. I think it's the one where they make clothes for models, not where they're models. And they had
Project Runway.
That it might have been that one, but there's a lot of copycats too.
Oh.
You know, I forget which one it was. I think it might have been though, because they had that guy Tim Gunn. Is that his name? I think it's Tim Gunn.
I think so.
Yeah, he's funny. I like him. But they had like male models on, and they're all like they look amazing. I know like women being emaciated, it's like a female model thing. But even the male models, they look like little boys. I couldn't believe how skinny their legs were. Their legs were literally as skinny as my wrist or skinnier, you know. And so I interviewed this band once, and one guy in the band is a male model, and he's extremely skinny and extremely tall. And he did a couple of photo shoots for this guy who's kind of like the Rick Rubin in the fashion world. And so they were talking in awe of this guy who's like, and I'm like, I don't even know who this guy is. So I Googled this guy. This guy is like extremely famous. Like he's a rock star of fashion. Like he is extremely rich. If you're into fashion, like you know who this guy is. But here's the thing, man. Like I was Googled this guy. And, like, they had, like, a photo shoot that he did, and it was all, like, 15 and 16 and 14-year-old boys in jeans and no shirt drinking alcohol and, like, partying. And this guy's, like, taking photos of it, and people are like, oh, look at these photos. Aren't these so great? And I kind of think maybe the fashion world is taking a blind eye to this. I mean, like, Joel, if you went over, I don't know, your friend's house, and he had, like, a photo book, and this guy's, like, old. This guy's, like, 80 or 75 or something. If you went over your friend's house and he had like a photo book of like drunk, half-naked 14, 15, 16-year-old boys or 14, 15, 16-year-old girls, wouldn't that be a cause for alarm for you? Wouldn't you be like, what's going on here?
I don't know if I'd stage an intervention, but yeah, it seems like that maybe would be a little weird or a lot weird.
And they like call like these kids his muses. Doesn't that imply that like you're having a sexual relation? I mean, I know what a Greek muse is, but doesn't that imply there's a sexual relationship when someone has a muse?
That's a good question.
And should a 75-year-old man even be hanging around like 14 and 15-year-old boys like out at the club and stuff? Or girls? I mean, it's not a gender thing, it's an age thing. You know what I mean?
Like, do we know if there was alcohol in the bottles, or was it like a Motley Crue thing where it's just half filled with iced tea?
It could have been, but I feel like there's a bunch of kids being abused in the high fashion world, and everyone just turns their eye to it. I can't prove this. I've just been thinking about this. Let's talk about Joel Tannenbaum. Joel,
are you sure that you wanted to get off that train of thought you were on there?
Well, the more I look into this, it just seems so obvious to me.
I don't know if we should talk about Joel at all. I think we should continue to try to solve this this problem that you've uncovered.
But Adam, do you agree with me? Like if you went over your friend's house and there's like a bunch of photos of like 15-year-old girls drinking.
No, I'm totally lying. Let's talk to Joel about
Joel. Anyways, Joel, listen. Joel has got a new project. It's called The Rentiers. I love this project. It's basically him and whoever he feels like recording with. He's been recording with Mikey Erg. He's been recording with Anika Pyle. He's been recording with the guy from Floating Action. Joel, why did you decide to do a kind of solo project where anything goes and there really is no genre requirements?
I think I hit a point last year where I kind of figured I had nothing to lose, if that makes any sense. So I would just do whatever I felt like, and that's what I've been doing. It's been all right.
And so I guess you've already got a 12-inch out. You've got a new single coming out in November. We debuted it at Punk News, and we're going to play a track from it. Joel, can we talk about all the tracks or just the track that's been released so far?
Sure, man. We can talk about all two of them.
Well, there's one track called Black Metal Yoga, which I love, which is – well, I'm not exactly sure what it's about. Joel, what's Black Metal Yoga about, and are you into yoga? Are you a yoga guy?
I'm kind of into yoga, I think, more than you're probably supposed to admit if you're in a punk band or whatever. But no,
like, yoga is very punk now. I mean,
okay, well, there you go. I guess I was ahead of the curve.
Do you do yoga weekly?
No, I haven't in a while. Since I moved to Center City, I kind of fell off the yoga train because the studios down here are kind of different, kind of lame in a way, you could say.
See, I hate yoga because it's supposed to like give you inner peace or whatever, but mm-hmm. I get angrier when I do it. Like, the monotony and slow pacing just makes me more and more pissed off, and I dwell on the things that are making me angry or annoyed from the week while I'm doing it. I hate yoga, Joel. I hate it.
Well, I respect that position, but you're into sports, right?
I don't watch sports. I enjoy playing sports.
Okay, yeah. Well, yoga is like sports, but for me.
So, Joel, why Black Metal Yoga? What's the deal with Black Metal Yoga?
It's just supposed to, you know, that saying, whatever gets you through the night, that's really what the song's about. It's just about, you know, getting through stuff. And Black Metal Yoga was just a fun kind of couple concepts to put together. And I was reading this book by Philip K. Dick at the time called Martian Time Slip, and a lot of that kind of made it into there as well.
So you got Mike Yerg on the track, you got Anika Pyle on the track. Mike Yerg, what's he like, not as Mike Yerg on the stage, but Mike Yerg playing music with you privately? What's Mike Yerg like up close?
He's great. He's great, man. He's a great guy. I consider him a good friend.
What do you and Mikey Erg talk about?
Music. I'd say 90% music and 10% stand-up comedy.
Mikey Erg is mega into music. What's something that surprised you about Mikey Erg music-wise that he really enjoys?
Oh, boy. There's actually a lot. I've yet to find a genre of music that he doesn't know something about and have some informed opinion about. He knows a lot about jazz, which was kind of hinted at in some of the Erg's records. But yeah, he's definitely a pretty serious jazz listener, in addition to everything else in the world. Every, like, 50s, you know, doo-wop band or 60s, you know, girl group or anything you could think of. Like, he's got a very deep knowledge of music and a very deep love of music.
And how about Anika Pyle? You know, I think people know her on stage, but I think, at least in the punk news world, she's a little bit like Mikey Yerg is a personality people know, but I think Anika Pyle is less understood, less there's not quite a familiar connection between Anika Pyle and the punk news team. Anika Pyle, what's she like?
I don't know her as well, but she is all class, and she is an amazing singer and amazing songwriter as well.
Fair enough.
Very great to work with.
Now, let's talk about the B-side. I love the B-side of the 7-inch. It's out on Baldy Longhair Records in November. It's called Drunks and Stoners. And first of all, it's exactly 4 minutes and 20 seconds long, which is the funniest thing ever. And it's a ska song or reggae song. And I was, Joe, the idea behind the song is, you know, there's punks, which are drunks, I guess, and hippies, which are stoners. And you've got a refrain in it. It's like two ways to go to the grave or something like that. What's the line?
Two different ways of navigating the darkness. And two different ways of ending up in a hearse. And it's not, I mean, hippies and punks rhymed or whatever, but you find plenty of examples of both in the punk scene and in every scene. And I guess what I was thinking about was just like, it's kind of these two tribes, you know, people who sort of get through life using different tools, and they end up having very different personalities, and they all kind of have to deal with each other. They all kind of have to work with each other. And sometimes it's difficult, and sometimes it's cool, and sometimes it's sad. And that's what the song's about.
Both tracks on the new 7-inch, they seem to be about getting through things. Why is that something you're focusing on? You know, I think of Black Randy and the Metro Squad. I think of some Dwarves tracks. I think of some Germs tracks, and it's very nihilistic. But you have a more let's get through this together kind of attitude. How come?
I don't know. Maybe because I do a lot of yoga. I don't know. I mean, it's just a way of seeing the world, I guess. But I hardly know anyone who's exactly where they want to be in life. Everybody's, you know, trying to get somewhere and they're not quite there. And that just sort of bleeds into, you know, songs, I suppose.
Well, let's try to get where we want to be by playing this wonderful Rentiers track. I've heard this new 7-inch. It's great, people. You should check out the 7-inch. This is Black Metal Yoga off the 7-inch. Black Metal Yoga out on Baldy Longhair Records in November. Let's go.
Whatever keeps you out of the academy, man, just grab it and hold on to it with both hands. It doesn't have to make sense, it doesn't have to be good. We're doing black metal yoga in our neighborhood.
Whatever keeps you out of a cubicle, girl, just hold on to it like it's the end of the world. It doesn't have to be cool, it doesn't have to be green. South of the Marianas Trench, me and Philip K. Dick and Father Divine doing sun salutations, just passing the time. The dishwashers were Finns, the cooks were Norwegian. We heard Bathory songs blaring out of the kitchen. The miners went on strike and attacked the police, so the governor gave us all early release. I arrived back on Earth wearing fingerless gloves, preaching black metal yoga and a message of love. Black metal yoga and a message of love. You don't have to be cruel, you don't have to be tough. Black metal yoga and a message of love. Black metal yoga and a message of love. Black metal yoga and a message of love. You don't have to be cruel, you don't have to be tough. Just black metal yoga and a message of love. Whatever gets you out of the hospital, my friend, just grab it, hold on to it right to the end. It doesn't have to be real, it doesn't have to be right. If black metal yoga helps you sleep through the night, and whatever gets you out of this terrible place, just grab it and let it lift you right into space. You'll arrive back on Earth wearing fingerless gloves. Black metal yoga and a message of love. Black metal yoga and a message of love. You don't have to be cruel, you don't have to be tough. Just black metal yoga.
And we are back. And we talked about this last week, but I'm curious on Joel's take on this subject, and Adam White, if he's got anything else to contribute. As you mentioned last week, the front woman of a band called Counterfeit, her name is Haley Eady, allegedly, we don't know if she did or she didn't, but allegedly she faked having stage 3 cervical cancer. And basically, a organization called Hardcore Cares set up a GoFundMe for her. They did some benefit shows for her. They sold some shirts for her to raise money for her cancer treatment. And according to the organization, turns out she didn't have cancer, and it was really just to scam people out of money. The organization said they're not going to try to get the money back. They didn't say why. It's probably because it'll cost them too much to get it back, and they might not even get it back. Joel, you were a punk rocker in the 90s. You're still a punk rocker, but you were a punk rocker in the 90s when shit was really gnarly in Philadelphia. We're talking Stylog. We're talking the Halfway House. A lot of nasty stuff gone down in Philadelphia. Is this as nasty? Is this as devious? Allegedly, rather. Is something like this as devious as the stuff you saw in the 90s? Is it worse? Is it better? Is punk rock more sinister these days or less sinister?
Well, there were definitely benefit shows where, you know, the money kind of disappeared. That was definitely something that would happen once in a while. Not at Stalag ever, but, you know, other places. And I suppose that dynamic's always there, but I think the difference now is that things like crowdsourcing and social media just make it so if you want to scam people, you can just do it on such an epic scale. And I think that's probably something like that happening here.
With regards to punk rock, I mean, do you find that the scene is more police than it used to be or less police than it used to be? I kind of feel as though there's less real maniacs out there doing really nasty stuff, although I could be wrong. We talked about this last week, and actually we're going to talk about this next week too. But I mean, you know, I feel as though punk rock goes through waves. In the late 70s, people weren't really that vicious, but then, you know, when hardcore came around, you had some true misanthropes, you know, guys that would just go to concerts to beat people up and stuff. Then, you know, that kind of died out in the late 80s. In the early 90s, you know, drugs got kind of heavy in the punk rock scene, and people got, you know, kind of vicious and a lot of problems. Where are we at right now? The punk rock scene, is it safer than it used to be, or is it less safe, or are there more really nasty characters out there?
Oh, I think that if you are just some random sociopath, it's harder to get away with stuff now than it was, you know, 15 or even 10 years ago, because people just have all these ways of communicating with each other now that they didn't. So scummy people tend to get found out more quickly. And in general, I think there's just sort of more enforcement of community standards, if that makes any sense. So I'd say, if anything, the shadiness is dialed back quite a bit. I think what might be more exaggerated now is the overt careerism. I think there's maybe a little bit more of that now. But then again, that was around back then too, because there was a period in, like, you know, 95, 96, 97, where people sensed there was money to be had, largely because of the success of Dookie and records like that. And so, yeah, there were definitely people in there trying to make a buck. But, I mean, as far as the kinds of behaviors you're talking about, I think it's harder to get away with stuff now than it used to be.
Well, that amplification is the same reason why I think, like, that this story is one that we're hearing about these days anyways. I mean, you know, there were probably absolutely all sorts of scams, maybe not to this level, but that were happening back in the day. But if it happened in, you know, in the local Boston scene or something like that, there's no reason that anyone of us would have heard about it, you know, outside of intersecting with someone from that. So this is probably one of those things where, like, the internet's, you know, it's making it harder to get away with stuff, but at the same time, it amplifies the stuff that you do get away with. Well, I mean, the stuff that you get caught doing. Yeah. So
actually,
I definitely agree.
Here's a question that I just realized, and I wrestle with this question a lot. When someone does something bad to someone else, it seems to me that the prevailing punk rock ethos is, we'll all take the higher ground and I won't strike back. But I often feel as though when someone is doing something wrong, and I don't just mean something that you think is offensive or annoying, but genuinely wrong, you should try to kind of break that behavior or stop that or get some sort of retribution, because otherwise that person will never get retribution and that kind of behavior will just persist. I mean, I realize this is a very ethereal conversation and very – I'm not using any specific examples. I'm being very broad. But, I mean, I'm just curious. You're two guys. Do you guys – if someone does something wrong to you guys, both of you, do you guys say, I'm going to get that guy back and teach him a lesson, or you just say, I'm going to take the high ground? Because I kind of think the quote high grounds, and this is my opinion, doesn't serve the function that people think it serves.
Well, I think you're right, and this is something I've thought about it a lot. I mean, certain types of behaviors, if people are always looking the other way, then the message that the person gets is, well, I can get away with this, so I'm going to keep doing it. I mean, I'm not a revenge guy.
I am.
Oh, there you go. I've never found revenge to be that satisfying personally, but I do call things out. And when I see something funny going on, I usually point it out to the person, and that has definitely that's definitely not how everyone does things nowadays. For sure.
John, I don't know, man. I don't find that I get into all that many conflicts, but when I do, I just sort of hope that the universe will smite them and I go and crawl into a dark hole and be angry somewhere. That's probably more what actually happens in real life than whatever I'm going to say. And usually the universe smites them, so I'm on good terms with cosmic forces.
We're each on three different poles here. I find that when people that are assholes, the universe usually doesn't smite them. And unless you directly go out and do what you need to do, then they're just going to get away with it and be all that much better for it.
Well, I don't mean like that they walk out of their house one morning ready to go to work and they get attacked by like a condor. What I mean is that like whenever there's been someone in my life where like I've gotten that sense that I'm like this person is actually sort of a scumbag and it's just a between me and them kind of thing, I will eventually learn that there's a whole sea of people that knows and acknowledges that said person is a scumbag, and that makes me feel good. So, you know, it's that kind of smite, the quiet social smite, not the condor kind.
Well, speaking of the opposite of that, Adam, I think you've got an interesting story about revenge, don't you?
I do. Do I? Is this the Cro-Mag story?
It's not the Cro-Mag story.
Not the Cro-Mags, a Cro-Mag. Yeah, all right. So, Harley Flanagan, John's buddy.
No, don't get me stabbed, Dad.
Who used to be in Cro-Mags has announced a new album. That album is called Cro-Mags. But it's not a Cro-Mags album. It's just called Cro-Mags, as in that's the title. The second thing on the spine. So now this is a Flanagan solo album. It is not a Cro-Mags album. Now, he, of course, previously released an album called Cro-Mag, singular.
So he's building on his previous work.
Yeah. It's like Alien and then Aliens. I think it's that kind of thing. Yeah. So now he released Cro-Mag with his band Harley's War. So this thing has 12 tracks, 25 minutes, out in January 15th of 2016 on MVD. Doesn't MVD release DVDs? Is that not what they do?
They do, but they release some albums too. Actually, and people always think we're getting payola. MVD, I don't like everything they put out, but the MVD puts out some really neat stuff. And actually, they just put out that Joe Strummer documentary, I Need a Dodge, and we're going to review that at Punk News, which is cool.
Back in the day when I used to get a lot of promo records and things like that, I got on an MVD list, and I would always get like handfuls of like weird like Iggy Pop live in 1978 at some club, kind of like bootlegs and stuff.
Oh, and it sounds like Static, the whole album.
It sounds like Static, the whole, yeah. But, although I did get one of them that was apparently signed by Iggy Pop. I don't really know if that's true, but anyways, yeah, so MVD. You can find the whole track listing to the Harley Flanagan album called Cro-Mags on Punk News right now. I don't know if there's any music from this online yet.
But what are some of the song titles, Adam?
Okay, some of the song titles on this one here. Guilty Until Proven Innocent, Mess With The Bull, I'll Fuck You Up, Fighting the Urge to Kill.
Harley writes what he knows. He's like Hank Moody.
Oh, so John, talk yourself out of getting stabbed here.
Okay, well, in case the listeners don't know, Cro-Mags are, if you don't have the Age of Quarrel album, you need to get that. That is a legendary punk album. It's kind of the first NYHC album, and I think it's the best, too. It's an amazing, amazing album. There's four Cro-Mags. Well, actually, there's five originally, or four, but there's two main ones. John Joseph, the vocalist, and Harley Flanagan, the bassist. And they've pretty much hated each other ever since they formed the band, and they've broken up and gotten back together a whole bunch of times. I think they're both geniuses. Literal, when it comes to music, I think they're both literal geniuses. And I think they are probably the two most insane artists you will ever – both of them. They are both completely out of their skull, especially Harley. Harley is a maniac, and I think he'd be complimented if he said that. After a lot of bitter feud, it would go back and forth. After they broke up one of the times, sometimes John Joseph would be the Cro-Mags. Sometimes Harley Flanagan would be the Cro-Mags. I think somehow John Joseph – retained their final rights to the name, so the only Cro-Mags now are John Joseph. So about 2 or 3 years ago, for some reason, Harley Flanagan tried to go to a Cro-Mag show, and he had a knife with him, and he ended up getting, well, who knows what happened, but he ended up in the hospital with like a broken leg, but he had a knife on him. However, charges against Harley Flanagan were dropped, even though he went to the show with a knife. So these guys are some crazy guys, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. With a broken leg?
His leg got like mutilated, like bone was sticking out.
It takes a bit to break a leg. Like, that's a...
Well, I wasn't there, and no one knows what went down, but let me tell you, I don't want to get involved in a scuffle between any of the guys on any faction of this conflict. You know what I'm saying? Johnny G staying out of this one, you know? I admire both artists quite a bit. I think they're both amazing artists. The great quagmire, the Cro-Mags, or the great irony, is that I think John Joseph is one of the greatest vocalists ever, and he's one of the greatest lyricists ever. Harley Flanagan says John Joseph never wrote any of the lyrics, but if you look at John Joseph's non-Cro-Mags lyrics, his lyrics are just as great as Age of Quarrel. Contemporaneously, Harley Flanagan, without question, invented that New York hardcore sound, but he's still a little more punk than the rest of those guys sound-wise. He is one of the greatest bass players ever, and he's a great song composer. But the irony, of course, is John Joseph rarely has musical backing that can meet Harley Flanagan, and Harley Flanagan doesn't have the vocal fronting that can back his amazing music. Just to go to show that this is crazy, this album was supposed to come out on Southern Lord, and there's all these announcements about it, but of course it collapsed, like all things Cro-Mags do, into just cacophony and chaos, and that's why it's coming out on MVD. So... The name of this album is a stab, if you will, at John Joseph. Harley Flanagan was actually like joking about that. Like, he's like, this will really stick it to him. And he's obviously talking about John Joseph. So these guys are maniacs. People always want them to get back together. I don't think they'll get back together. Joel, do you think there's a chemistry between these two? What's your take on this album? I mean, are you a fan of the Cro-Mags?
I'm not going to say too much about the Cro-Mags, but I will say this. You guys didn't get the tracks for this, right? Like, you haven't actually heard any of the music, right?
Well, some songs were posted online when it was supposed to be a Southern Lord record. Oh, okay. I've heard two of them, I think, or maybe one. And it was a lot like the Cro-Mags record Revenge.
So it's not an acoustic album is what you're saying. This isn't Harley Flanagan with an acoustic guitar.
Not quite. Maybe next time. That was All Fuck You Up.
Well, maybe the next one will be called The Cro-Mags. Continue with the trend, and maybe it'll just be him and a guitar.
Yeah, where can he go from there? He's got Cro-Mag and Cro-Mags. I mean, where else can you go?
I like Cro-Mag with a little like a cube 3, you know, like a superscript 3.
Maybe throw an umlaut in there somewhere.
Well, there you go. A lot of people don't know about Harley Flanagan. He really is an amazing fellow. He published a book of poetry when he was like 13. The foreword was by Allen Ginsberg. He toured with The Clash when he was like 15. And he's credited as introducing skinhead culture to America. I can't confirm or deny that, but people claim it. And I kind of believe it, honestly. Anyways, let's talk some more retro stuff. Apparently, it's a big thing now to put video game soundtracks on vinyl records. And actually, there's a company called Data Discs in Western London that's having a sort of boom where they're putting like Streets of Rage and a game called Shinume on vinyl records. And apparently, people are buying them. Now, I think Adam White and I are going to disagree about this, but I kind of feel as though this represents a nadir of culture and creativity. And much like the ancient Egyptians are judged by the fineness of their art, and the more blocky and the less refined their art became, the worse their economy was, the ancient Egyptians, I kind of feel that's what this signifies to us, and that we're claiming that buzzes and beeps are valid, or not only valid, but an apogee of music, when I find it to be the opposite. Adam White, what's your take?
Apogee was an old video game company.
Yeah, Duke Nukem 1 and 2, Biohazard. Was it Biohazard or BioWare?
So anyways.
Biomenace.
We're not that far apart on this, John.
Commander Keen.
Anyways, yeah. I don't think we're all that far apart on this. I'm not a gamer. I don't do that. I don't play in that culture. I don't really know a lot about what happens. I'm one of these old people that at some point when I started having like a job and things, they're just, you know. There were no more video games after a certain point. And the thought of you know, reimmersing myself in that, whenever I think about that, and I think fondly of doing that, I just think like, wow, I have lots of stuff to do. And then it never happens. So yeah, I don't, that's not my culture. So I don't really know it. I mean, like, I grew up as a Nintendo kid. So I guess like when I was like 12, it was my culture, but not anymore. No, the reason why, John, I think that you and I, you thought there was going to be more of a disagreement here was just that, like, when you said that, oh, there's people releasing video game music on vinyl, I'm like, holy shit, I just bought some video game music on vinyl, and I thought that this was going to be more of that. But I think that was a little bit of a special case. So, like, my example of this, and this is maybe the example of when you should release your video game music on vinyl is, so I'm back from my days in Guelph, Ontario there, when I was really into a label that was out for a little while called Three Gut Records. Those Three Gut was the label that released the first stuff from the Constantines. There was a band that was on Three Gut called Royal City that I was a big fan of. One of the guys that was in Royal City is a guy named Jim Guthrie. Now, Jim has a solo career that he does all kinds of crazy solo acoustic stuff. But aside from that, being a singer-songwriter, he really early on was making weird, like, beep-boop music with video game stuff. And one of Guthrie's first solo records back in, this has been like 2003 or something like that, I got to find out what the name of the tool was. He actually used this music game that you could get on a PlayStation to make a bunch of the music that ended up on this first album of his. There was a thing on a play. Where is it here?
It was called Music 2000. I think there was a Norwegian band called Toyen. That was just these two guys who made a whole record of nothing but that.
And it was actually really cool. Music Generator. This one was called.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Guthrie's first solo record had a whole bunch of like that kind of stuff on it. And while that is by no means my favorite of his stuff, because it is a bunch of electronic beeping and things like that, he's done a lot of cool stuff since that. And the one that really came to mind for me, and the one that like I actually have on vinyl, was he a couple years ago, I don't know the exact year, 2011. He was part of a group of indie game developers, that I think they're out of Toronto, that put together a game that was an iPad game that I think it's available on all the things now, called Sword and Sorcery. And the Sword and Sorcery game was kind of like a throwback retro game with a bunch of kind of Zelda motifs in it. But it used Guthrie's music to a huge degree, to the point where, like, when the game started, his name was one of the first things on the screen, like music by Jim Guthrie, you know, make sure you put in your headphones. And, you know, it was an incredibly atmospheric game, and there was all this vinyl worked into the game itself. And the actual name of the game was like the Sword and Sorcery EP. And then after that came out, Jim turned around and he released the Sword and Sorcery LP, which was like the actual vinyl of the music that he had recorded for the game, which is, I think, a little bit more... It was a little bit more orchestrated than just, you know, like old school beeps and boops, although that was definitely an element in it. But like Owen Pallett, the violin player who did a bunch of stuff with Broken Social Scene, he was on the record. So it was like a legit thing. And anyways, though, I really liked that game, which is one of the only ones I've played in the past many years. And I really liked that soundtrack, and I own it on vinyl, and I'm okay with that. I don't know at the same point if I would go get like the music from Mega Man 2 on vinyl. That seems like it would be more kitschy than actually benefiting of being on that medium. But yeah, so that's my long story about Jim Guthrie that has video game connections. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know, John. I don't know if I need like the music from Super Mario 2.
Can I add 2 points?
Yes.
One, Casio, I mean, in defense of this kind of music, like, or music that sounds like this, Casio Core was like a thing that happened in the late 90s and early 2000s. It was like a real thing that happened for a while. And then in the mid 2000s, there was this whole 8-bit thing, which seemed like kind of an offshoot of gamer and coder culture. Are you guys familiar with this?
Oh, and not only am I familiar with it, Joel, I've been to many of those shows.
Really?
Because Narboots often is booked at those kinds of shows because the gamer kids like Narboots, whereas the punk kids hate them, despite the fact that Narboots is the most punk band there is.
Cool. And did I have another point? No, I think those are my 2 points.
Well,
actually, I do have another point. Can I just make my other point?
Yeah, Joel.
This one time, there's this weird, weird coffee shop right on the edge of Chinatown in Philadelphia called Ray's, and it's still open, I think. But years ago, I was in there once, and they were listening to the most beautiful music I ever heard. And it was these gamer kids working behind the counter. And I know nothing about video games, but it was so cool that I went up and asked the kid what the music was, and he was like, oh, it's the Final Fantasy VII soundtrack. So I think I'm okay with that.
So coming back to John, is this the end of is this the end of culture? I don't like the video game kids have an astonishing amount of money and they are driving lots of media and lots of decisions that are made. I don't know if necessarily that crowd overlaps a huge amount with I don't know, people building record collections necessarily. I've got to imagine that this isn't meant to sell to. This isn't meant to sell like kids buying like Call of Duty 15 or whatever they buy. I think this is meant to sell to like, you know, like 35-year-old men that played Sega Genesis as a kid and now have disposable income.
I just wonder if it's a sign that people are not as sophisticated as to all things than they used to be, you know?
I don't know. Like, John, I listen to a lot of music that has a gruff-voiced man screaming about puke. And
yeah.
That doesn't really I can't make the argument that things aren't sophisticated enough.
That's more sophisticated than video game music, but maybe that's just because I'm biased. See, to me, that seems to be a statement on the human condition.
Okay.
You don't think beeping?
Go on. Don't leave us hanging on that one.
Oh, well like let's take a gruff voice man screaming about puking. Let me think. Mm-hmm. Let me think. Well, let's just use Black Randy the Metro. You guys know Black Randy?
No, I don't.
Oh, Black Randy's a legendary. Well, he's dead. He's been dead for years. He was a Danger House artist, and he has all these songs about stealing money from people and doing drugs and sleeping on the street. And actually, that was a keyboard-driven band. How fitting that we're talking about Casio Core music. I feel as though that is specifically a reaction to the existential, the life that people are dropped into. And he's commenting on that despite all the forces that are active in a person's life, that the situation in which we were put in is unfair and unsuitable for life itself. What seems to be, I don't agree with that, mind you, but to me it's a very clever, a very dark, and a very sophisticated opinion. Whereas, you know, the Mega Man 2 music, you know, boot doot 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 bum bum bum, boot doot 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 bum bum bum. I mean, it works for a video game, but it's not high art, if you will.
Oh, and also, here's another point. When I read this story, my first thought, if I'm being honest, was great, more boutique crap backing up the pressing plants.
Oh, actually, Joel, let's talk about that. Maybe you and I disagree on this scenario. I actually don't blame them for backing up the pressing plants because, A, pressing plants are getting money, but mm-hmm. also, I mean, like, well, I mean, can you punish? I mean, is it the guy, the people putting out this record are businessmen? Is it business's job to make sure that artists can do artists' things? That's the question.
No, I mean, in a capitalist, you know, economy, that's obviously not how it's going to work. But I mean, I think just from the, you know, from the perspective of just speaking on behalf of punk labels who are trying to press 300, 500, maybe 1,000 copies of a record in time for a band to go on tour or go to fest or whatever, all of this sort of resurgence of boutique vinyl has been a disaster. Because records end up getting pushed to the side for 6-8 months because all of a sudden whatever, you know, latest thing is getting reissued on vinyl, the people who are behind it have real money and they're like, we want, you know, 2,000 copies of Pet Sounds on 180, you know, gram vinyl in time for Record Store Day, and so many little labels that were the ones keeping these pressing plants in business for over a decade are really end up being the victims of that.
I understand that, actually. It's as though we kept you alive when no one else cared, but yeah. Now that you're getting more money from bigger corporations, you don't care about us anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe from their perspective, that's what they need to do to survive. So maybe it's just a capitalism problem. But it ends up from a band and label perspective, it can be very distasteful and very frustrating.
What's a record pressing machine cost?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I think people are trying to figure this out. For whatever reason, they don't seem able to make them. The economies of scale just don't add up, so you can't get some tool and die factory in China to just make you a pressing plant. So what's happening is there's a finite amount of them around the world that are getting bought up and rebuilt, and you keep hearing about further and further afield countries where pressing plants turn up. Like, there was one in Zimbabwe that everybody was talking about a couple years ago, and I think one in South Africa recently. I think another one turned up in one of those Central Asian countries. And then people are like, oh, it's on eBay. It's $10,000. It's $20,000. Who wants to go to Zimbabwe? Apparently you have to hire a bodyguard. Things like that. Those are like the conversations that people are forced into having about vinyl pressing nowadays.
Yeah, I've heard that kind of stuff quite a bit actually recently, where all of a sudden there'd be some shuttered factory that they would go and pull the boards off the doors, and they realize that, like, oh hell, it's full of vinyl pressing from the 70s, and that becomes a big deal, because those things, yeah, you just can't buy one. But even scarier than that, it's like, some of these are just like run by old dudes that need to pass on their skills to,
yes,
because no one is necessarily teaching anyone how to run the plants. Like, it's an incredibly interesting problem. It absolutely sucks if you're a label or a band trying to get something pressed these days. John, I wonder how much that actually has to do with the tape resurgence.
Oh, and you know who's on the Punk News mixtape? Why Joel Tannenbaum and Ghost in the Graveyard. With his amazing. White Love Will Destroy You in the End, which I truly think that's an amazing song. I'm sorry, Adam.
No. By all means, compliment that song.
It's a great song. It is Bob Dylan dark, baby.
Thanks, so, guys. John, I was gonna play a cover of Iggy Pop's "Here Comes Success."
Let's do it.
That Royal City, that was the band that Jim Guthrie was in, put together. But I kind of actually want to play a song about throwing up instead, because it illustrates a point I was making earlier.
Let's do it.
So I can do both. So this is Royal City from Guelph, Ontario, with a cover of Iggy Pop's "Here Comes Success," followed by Brutal Knights and "Grow Up, Throw Up."
Here comes success
over my hill
here comes success
here comes my car
here comes my Chinese run. In the last ditch,
and that was Royal City and Brutal Nights. And I got to say, you know, for the I'm a huge Stooges fan, but for the longest time, I did not check out Iggy Pop's Lust for Life album. Because let's be real, Iggy Pop's got a lot of crappy solo albums. The Lust for Life album is almost as good as the Stooges. You have got to check out that album. Great album. Let's talk about a thing that Adam White has got to check out. One of Adam White's favorite newer bands, The Dirty Nil from Dundas, Ontario. The Dirty Nil have released a new track. It's called No Weaknesses, and it's off the A side of their new 7-inch out on Dynalone Records. Adam White, and they're also on tour. Adam White, what's happening with the? You are our Dirty Nil go-to guy. What's happening with The Dirty Nil? Did you dig this tune?
I did. They've been playing this song for a long time. I like how like abbreviated this song is, just because that I don't know. I have this certain fetish for songs that end before they should. And that this one seems like it does for me, but that's cool. I've heard them actually play the B side of this live, which is a cover of Provisional off the first Fugazi record. What was Provisional off of? Was it off of 13 Songs, or was it off of Repeater? Anyways, Provisional is an early Fugazi song. It's really good, and they cover it, and they're good covering it. So I'm curious to see what the actual B-side sounds like on record. I'm optimistic that this band's first full length is going to be cool, because I've liked everything that they've done up until now, and I seem to be their punk news champion. But I feel that I've beat that drum a lot, and the people seem to recognize that they are a band that is good. So that's cool. I'm good with that. I love that they have managed to get Dundas, Ontario into the said by people like you, John, because it's almost an in-joke. It's almost a Delco kind of thing. I was saying to John while we were having some audio problems earlier that while you guys were talking, I was Googling Delco to try to find out what that was.
Sure.
But so Dundas is a fairly small little town. I mean, it's not tiny. It's like 20,000 people, but it's a town that is basically a few years ago was absorbed and amalgamated into Hamilton, Ontario, which is a much bigger town that I think people have heard of. And the Dirty Nil are proudly from Dundas. And every time they get on the stage, it's hi, we're the Dirty Nil from Dundas, Ontario. And it's almost like you can't absorb us, bigger city. We're from Dundas forever. So when John comes on the podcast and says the band from Dundas this is their plan. So I think that's funny.
Awesome. You know, I first heard the Dirty Nil via the Punk News podcast, and I was super into them, and I ordered their 7-inch. Like I literally listened to the podcast and ordered the 7-inch, which I think is actually how it's supposed to work, right?
Yeah, that's how I get royalties.
Cool. But they're playing in Philly again soon, and I'm going to try to go see them. I was like, who are these guys with these crazy like Alex Chilton songwriting chops? It was unbelievable. They're a really good band.
Listen, Joe, I want your perspective on this. Adam mentioned this. You know, there's a couple of bands that I'm always hyping on the Punk News podcast, and I kind of pulled back because I feel if I hype them too much, then people will get turned off. Can one hype a band too much? Can a media guy, like Adam White, Punk News is not gigantic, but Punk News has an audience. You know, we're not the world's biggest website by any stretch, but we do have an audience. Can Adam White and I damage a band by talking about them too much and how about how much we love them too much?
I think I'm the wrong person to ask. I think all my instincts about these things almost always turn out to be wrong.
Well, what's your instinct? So,
my instinct is no. I mean, the more you talk about it, the better. And people see how passionate you are about it, and they pick up on that. But since that's my instinct, we should probably assume that the opposite is actually correct.
Or are you saying
and there is a saturation point?
Or are you saying the opposite so people assume it's the opposite?
You know, I don't even know. It's like the Lollapalooza episode of The Simpsons where the one kid's like, are you being sarcastic, man? And the other kid's like, I don't even know anymore.
Well, speaking of people being sarcastic, It's been a wild ride for Blake Schwarzenbach over the last week. In the beginning, maybe it was late last week, he announced the tour. People were excited. Blake Schwarzenbach solo, about 7 or 8 dates. Well, just today he canceled it. I've never been a Jawbreaker. I'm not trying to be a hater. I've never been a Jawbreaker fan. I've never really understood why people love them so much. And frankly, I've never understood why people that want their punk rock fix would go to Jawbreaker, if you will. Joel, I believe you are a Jawbreaker / Blake Schwarzenbach guy, aren't you not?
Yeah, that's mostly correct. They were definitely a big influence on me when I was a kid. And I had all the records and saw them play live once, I think, and thought that they were really smart guys who wrote good songs. But having said that, especially in the current climate, I would actually say they're overrated. But that's kind of hard to say in like the Twitter world nowadays, because a band can be overrated and still be a really important, excellent band. And I think that's the category that they're kind of in right now. If that makes any sense.
You know, Blake Schwarzenbach is known for covering like Third Eye Blind live and stuff. That just seems repulsive to me. I mean, I'm being a little dramatic. I mean, if Blake Schwarzenbach covers Third Eye Blind, I don't really care. But like, if we're debating punk concept just for fun, I would say that's repulsive to the punk, I guess, ethos or the idea of punk itself. Am I being reactionary?
Well, I think there's some context that's helpful. So he's a 90s guy, and in the context of the 1990s, liking Third Eye Blind or covering a Third Eye Blind song or saying anything positive about Third Eye Blind would have actually really pissed people off.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
But so now it's like, that's almost like a fashionable band to cover. So I think you have to look at the context. And I think the main thing about, I don't know the guy, but I mean, I think the main thing about that dude is that he's doing whatever he wants to do at any given moment. And he's not really concerned about whether people like it or not.
I guess I'd be more interested if what he'd like to do was sonically more dangerous, you know?
Like, sure. Like, if you what did you think of the Forgetter stuff? I think that's what he was trying to do with the Forgetters.
Yeah, well, I forgot it, let me tell you.
Yeah. But John, I don't know if there's like an element of like love the band, hate their fans that kind of works in with Jawbreaker. At least that's always how it was for me. Like, I didn't listen to them when they were first around. Like, they were a band that I came back to later, and I came back to them sort of begrudgingly because like back in this would have been back in like the mid 2000s on Punk News, when I remember that, like, you know, like Scott Heisel and everyone else was like just, you know, enormous Jawbreaker fans, enormous Jess to Brazil fans. And it was one of those bands that I had to like begrudgingly listen to just because I felt that, you know, if I didn't go force myself to find out who this band is, then I'm going to sound illiterate when we're talking about them. But you know what? I really like a lot of the stuff that they put out. I definitely like their stuff when it was like a little bit earlier and a little bit rawer sounding, but that's preference on my part, really. But I think that they suffer a little bit from being too, you know, a little bit too beatified by people. I've got to imagine that's maybe a little bit more about what you're dealing with.
Nice.
You're saying it in nicer language, but I think that's the same thing. I mean, I don't think any punk band can survive being canonized like that without some problems. But my take on it is actually the opposite. I mean, as far as their catalog, I actually find the early two albums to be a pretty mixed bag. It's the last two that I really like. And the funny thing about that, as far as like the great Jawbreaker revival that started however many years ago, everybody seems to have forgotten that when their fourth album came out, their major label album, people hated it. They hated it. It was almost universally despised, and went out of print forever. You couldn't even get it. And then somewhere about 10 years ago, there was this weird like revisionist history that went on where all of a sudden everybody decided that was like they were the greatest band in the world and that was the greatest record in the world. And it was strange to watch it happen.
Can that be called like – was the album like Pinkertoned? Is that like – did that not happen with that? Did everyone hate that, or was it just that the label hated Pinkerton when it was out?
I think people liked Pinkerton, although not as much as they like it now. I think people hated the Green album, and as far as I can tell, they still kind of hate it.
Yeah, when I'm saying earlier Jawbreaker, I mean I don't really I, what I mean is not earlier. I mean 24 Hour, like 24 Hour is kind of the sweet spot for me. Like I like a lot of stuff on Dear You, but it's definitely one of those things that it's a little bit too. Just production-wise, is a little bit too samey for me, I guess.
Hey, you would have fit right in back in the day, man, because that's what everybody thought.
I know, and I don't necessarily think those people were wrong. Like, it's not offensive to me because I have no real emotional tie to the band one way or the other. But I can kind of see how like I like the other stuff better. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing how that record in particular has just become like. Yeah, like people swear by it as if it like when it emerged, it changed their lives. But you know, most people probably weren't even able to pick it up because it was like I remember like I found a copy of it on CD at one point, and this was when my like early exploration of Jawbreaker, which was still way after the fact, had gone on, And people were like, holy shit, you actually found a copy of it somewhere? Like, that's that's a big deal. Like, you could not find a copy of that somewhere.
I sold my vinyl copy of Dear You in 2003 for like $80 on eBay. Like, no problem. People were just waiting to grab it up and pay any amount of money for it. It was crazy.
Which, adjusted for inflation, is like $3,000 today.
Yeah, basically. In 2015 dollars. So, yeah, there you go. I think the problem with the earlier Jawbreaker albums for me was that there was a lot of artsy stuff that kind of didn't, you know, hit the target. And then I think by the time they got to 24 Hour, they were like, this is the kind of songs we write and this is the kind of things we sing about. And they had it, like, down. That's the stuff I really remember fondly.
So were you a Jets to Brazil guy?
Yes, not their whole catalog, but whatever the Orange album was. I love that. I went to see them play at the church. It was interesting. It was kind of a nightmare of a show because there was like all this like sort of almost pseudo like hardcore gang violence that took place at the Jets to Brazil show. It was very strange.
I can't imagine gang violence, like punk gang or like non-punk gang.
Well, like, I don't even think we should talk about this, but like Nine Circle type stuff, like the kind of stuff that was going on in the late 90s, there was like, it was bad. Like, there was people like hitting each other, somebody OD'd. Like, I was just like, this is a Jets to Brazil show, guys. Like, what are you doing here? You know? But that was Philly in the late 90s. Did I lose you guys?
Oh, no,
we're just in awe of the true danger that used to be the punk rock scene.
Oh, all right. What other
gang violence is overstating it, but it was, you know, there was stuff.
All right, John, what other short stories do we have here that we just want to make mention of this week? Speaking of things that people love, the Loved Ones, that was not meant to be a pun on their name, I mean this record, the Loved Ones have announced a show to celebrate the 10th anniversary of their 2006 release, Keep Your Heart. That show is going to happen on February 19th of next year at the Bowery Ballroom in New York City. Tickets go on sale this Friday, which is actually super early for a show next year. But anyways, Keep Your Heart came out in 2006 on Fat Records. People seem to really love that record. And if you want something that is very, very much held up as one of the orgcore classics, I guess that would be it. So, yeah, if you like the Loved Ones, you can go see them play it. John, do you got one more here?
Yeah, I'll just do a quick mention. Danger Friends, they put out a new video. Talking about sonically dangerous, I dig this band Danger Friends. It's kind of synth punk, sort of like the Screamers. It's kind of like if Screamers and Butthole Surfers kind of merged together. Like, very hard, sludgy, but sonic and kind of aggressive music. Check out Danger Friends. I dug the new EP a lot out on Kung Fu Records. It's a cool experimental record. That's the kind of punk I'm into these days.
Cool.
All right, John. I think that's all we have as far as news. Do you want to play one more song here?
I think I will. And it'll listen. People are always asking, when will John Joseph and Harley Flanagan get back together as the Cro-Mags and record a new Cro-Mags album? And I think they answered that question on the very first Cro-Mags album. And speaking of songs that contemplate the human existence, this contemplates the human existence and also answers the question, when will the Cro-Mags get back together? People say that Cro-Mags is meathead music. Cro-Mags is not meathead music. Cro-Mags is one of the deepest bands there really is, deeper than Jawbreaker, deeper than whatever guy that sits with a guitar and sings about whiskey and how being with his friends is special for him or whatever. This is the Cro-Mags contemplating how the universe itself works. This is off their debut, Age of Quarrel. This is World Peace, which has one of my favorite lines in all of music. Think about this for a while. World Peace can exist. It just can exist. No, I screwed that up. World Peace can't be done. It just can exist. This is the Cro-Mags. We'll be right back. And we are back, and there's not world peace right now, so I think that proves the Cro-Mags were right. Joel Tannenbaum, thanks for being on the podcast. It's always a pleasure to have you come in here and talk about what's happening with your latest bands, what's going on. So we got the Rentiers putting out a new 7-inch in November, and I think you've got some other things in the works. You want to talk about that, or is that top secret right now?
There's other projects, and there's a couple other things in the works that'll come out probably over the course of the next 8 months or something like that. You know, life will go on.
Well, listen, people, check out this Rentiers 7-inch. I definitely dig it. Adam White, as always, you are the sunshine of my life. You are my Sharia Moore. You are my partner. Adam White, thanks for being on the podcast.
So many people love me, but there's only one of me. I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
We'll see you next week.